Welcome to the Sadler Lectures podcast. Responding to popular demand, I'm converting my philosophy videos into sound files you can listen to anywhere you can take an MP3. If you like what you hear and want to support my work, go to patreon.com/sadler. I hope you enjoy this lecture. The first of the ideas of reason that Kant is going to examine in detail in the third part of his Prolegomena to Any Future Metaphysics is what is called the psychological idea or ideas. And we should mention at the very beginning that there is a bit of discrepancy or maybe even controversy here. Are these plural or is it singular? In the German text, it actually says Ideen, right? Plural. But then there's a footnote which actually says Idee. ? The editor themselves was unsure about this, and it kind of seems like we're talking about an idea, namely that of the soul, but perhaps there's multiple ones in play here. It's clear that in the two sections that follow that, the cosmological ideas are plural, and the theological idea is singular, but it's quite interesting to think about this one, and perhaps it'll get clear as we work through it. So why the psychological idea? Well, it does have to do with substance, but it has to do with the soul, the psyche in Greek. So psychological actually makes a lot of sense here. And he's going to begin by saying that people have long since observed that in all substances, the subject proper, that which remains after all the accidents as predicates, are abstracted, hence the substantial itself remains unknown, and various complaints have been made concerning these limits to our insight. So a lot to unpack there for anybody who isn't really well versed in the history of philosophy. What is Kant talking about? So in ancient and medieval, in modern philosophy, we have this notion of substance. And there's different ways of translating it. There's a long back history that we're not going to go into about whether ousia is the same thing as substantia. Suffice it to say that by Kant's time, this is a very well attested notion, right? And we see in whether it's, René Descartes or John Locke or other people, that there are different things that are being called substance. The idea that substance is that which remains after you take away all of the properties or qualities or predicates. It's the subject, the subjectum, the thing underlying everything else. This has been around for quite a while, and philosophers have attempted to examine and explain what substances are, all the way up to Hume, and said, a lot of time we don't actually know. Or they hold out a prospect that, at least we can know certain substances, like Descartes with the thinking substance that is ourselves, or René Descartes as well. So there's a couple different things going on here. We have the notion of subject and predicate, and we don't always use this today, but in Kant's time, this is quite common an approach. It's even used in metaphorical ways as well. And then we have the notion of substance as something which is enduring or permanent, something that is lasting. And Locke would try to say, what is the substance of gold? It's what remains after all these properties are taken away. And Kant goes on and he says, we should consider the human understanding as not to be blamed for its inability to know the substance of things, that is to determine it by itself, but rather for demanding to cognize it determinately as if it were a given object, it being a mere idea. It meaning substance. Now, a mere idea is a being of reason, a concept of reason. It's not something that can be grasped or verified in the scope of our experience, right? It pertains to the completion, the totality of our experience. So it cannot be encountered anywhere in experience. He says, Pure reason requires us to seek for every predicate of a thing its own subject. So this is Kant is saying this is inherent in reason. Anything that we can say about something, we need to have some subject that it is predicated of. And for this subject, which is itself necessarily nothing but a predicate, its subject, and so on indefinitely. But it follows we must not hold anything at all which we can arrive to be an ultimate subject, and that substance itself can never be thought by our understanding, however deep we may penetrate, even if all nature were unveiled to us. So the understanding can't grasp substance, even though perhaps reason wants it to. But reason perhaps could do this. And here now we see a very interesting move. This is why it's the psychological idea or ideas. So if we're going to not look at things outside of ourselves and say, there's a substance, because we can't get to the substantiality of the substances, what about looking at ourselves? This is the move that René Descartes makes, isn't it? Right? And many others as well. Maybe the ego, the ich, the subject that we are of all these representations, the subject that has reason, that has understanding, that has sensibility, maybe we're the substance. We are where we're getting the idea of substance from. He says, we appear to have this substance in consciousness, Bewusstsein, of ourselves. And notice the plural here. Isn't that interesting? He doesn't say the consciousness of myself, the consciousness of ourselves, which is supposed to be similar to each other, which makes perfect sense given everything else that Kant has said before this. And what is that consciousness of ourselves? As thinking subject, right? The subject that engages in thought. And he says, and indeed in an immediate intuition. This is where we get into trouble, right? An immediate intuition. He says, the predicates of an internal sense refer to the ego, the ich, the I, as a subject. So if I say, I think that Kant is a really insightful thinker, or I think that he's wrong about something, that I is the subject and thinks that Kant, etc., is the predicate. And so anything that is an I think, and if we're adopting, you know, René Descartes' famous enumeration of the different modes of thinking that we find in meditation too, a thing which affirms, which denies, which doubts, which wills again, so we could go on and on and on, right? All of those are predicates of the subject that is the, what Kant is calling the ego, the I here. And so he says, I cannot conceive of myself as the predicate of any other subject. So it looks like we've arrived at an absolute subject. He says, we have completeness in reference, Beziehung, in relation to given concepts, gegebene Begriffe, as predicate to a subject. And here he says, not merely as an idea, which is for reason, but as an object. And notice that he doesn't use the word Objekt, but he uses Gegenstand, which just earlier in the lead up to this, he's distinguished between these two and said that, you know, the ideas don't actually refer to objects in this sense, but rather represent to us Objekte, not Gegenstände. And so he says that not merely an idea, but an object, that is what I am, what you are, the absolute subject itself. And this seems to be given in experience. What kind of experience? The experience that I have of my own thinking. The experience that you have of your own thinking. The experience that, go back to the we here, we have as human beings of our own thinking, of thinking along with this long dead guy, Immanuel Kant. Right? So it seems like we now have a way to get at the absolute subject. We are wrong to seek it outside of ourselves. Instead, we should find it in ourselves, in the soul, in what is lasting, right? So he goes, well, this expectation is disappointed. This isn't going to work. Why not? The ego is not a concept, right? It's not a Begriff. And so he says that it can't be a predicate, but it also cannot be the concept of the absolute subject. object, right? It's only the indication of the object of the internal sense. So far as we cognize it by no further predicate, it cannot be a predicate of any other thing, but it can't be a determinate concept of the absolute subject, but is only the reference of the internal phenomena to their unknown subject. And he calls this a regulative principle. And so there's a very natural misunderstanding which infers the nature of the soul from this supposed cognition of the substance of our thinking being. And he says, well, this is specious because the knowledge of this substance would be outside of the complex of experience. Now, notice what he's saying there. The complex of experience, not just experience, an individual experience, but the totality of experience. We can't experience the absolute subject as the ego. So that's not going to work. And then he goes, you know, we might call this thinking self, the soul substance being the ultimate subject of thinking, which cannot be represented as the predicate of another thing, but it's quite empty and inconsequential if permanence, beharrlichkeit, right? A endurance, a perdurance. If this is not part of it, can't be proved of it. Now, there's a little bit of a mistranslation here, a misleading translation. The quality which renders the concept of substances and experience fruitful. There is no German term here corresponding to quality. That's been read in by the translator. So that could be a little bit misleading because a quality would be a predicate, right? So we don't want to think of it in that terms. We want to say that what makes a substance substance is indeed permanence. But is it? Well, Kant goes on and he says, permanence can never be proved of the concept of a substance as a thing in itself. So if we're considering our soul as a thing in itself, if we're considering external things as things in themselves, we can never prove permanence of any of them. And yet, on the other hand, it could be proved, at least for the moment, in experience, right? Because that's where we can register these things. So, you know, that's important. And then Kant is going to say, okay, I'll go with you on that. However, there's two problems. One of which he's going to talk about in terms of the soul. The other of which he's going to address more widely in a footnote. So, can we say that the soul really is permanent within the realm of experience? It's hard enough to get experience of the soul. Anyway, but he goes on and he says, from the concept of the soul as a substance, if we would infer its permanence, this can hold good as regards possible experience only, not of the soul as a thing in itself and beyond all possible experience. Okay, so far so good. This is what we've already said. Life is the subjective condition of all our possible experience. Consequently, we can only infer the permanence of the soul in life. For the death of man is the end of all experience. So now, we could say, well, wait a second, what if you outlive somebody else? Well, this idea of grasping the soul and experience, that really only works for yourself, like a first-person perspective. So even if I see somebody else living and dying and they communicate a lot to me, I can't like peer into their soul. I'm not having their experience. It's only mine, right? And so while I'm alive, sure, I can say, yeah, I'm the same guy. I'm the same substance while I'm alive, having experience. As soon as I die, I'm not having experience anymore. There's no me, there's no ego, no ich to have that any longer. So he says, the death of man is the end of all the experience that concerns the soul as an object of experience, unless you prove the contrary, and that would be circular because that is exactly what we're trying to figure out. So he says, the permanence of the soul can only be proved, and no one cares for that. It's not helpful during the life of man, but not as we desire to do after death. Why? The concept of substance, insofar as it's to be necessarily combined with the concept of permanence, can be so combined only according to principles of possible experience, therefore for the purposes of experience only. So we can't get an immortal soul as a permanent substance. We can't actually say even that the soul completely disappears. It's a blank, right? Then there's a really interesting footnote. And in this, Some of our worries about, well, wait a second, how do we experience substance are coming to the fore. So Kant says, it's indeed remarkable how carelessly metaphysicians have passed over the principle of the permanence of substances without attempting a proof of it. Why? Because they found themselves abandoned by proofs as soon as they began to deal with the concept of substance. Common sense, or rather, a little bit better translated, common understanding, right? Verstand. Common sense, which felt distinctly that without this presupposition, now presupposition is something that you're assuming, no union of perceptions and experiences possible, supplied the want, the mangel, by a postulate, right? So it projects something rather than actually proving it. And it projects this postulate of the permanence of substance. And it says it couldn't derive this from experience because why not? You never have experience of anything that actually is permanent. How could you? Because you only experience this much of, you know, time before, time afterwards. I mean, you might say, well, that mountain over there is permanent. What does geology tell us? No, they're not. They came into being at a certain time. Maybe they're permanent after that. Mountains erode. Nothing is really permanent in that sense. No object that we can encounter within the realm of our experience. And if you think about our own very limited experience, we can say, well, you know, I've had this book for years and years and years. That doesn't mean that it's permanent. Throw it in the trash. Let it go into a landfill. Get chewed up. Get eaten by something. The substance is permanent. The paper is still there. The paper's made of wood and ink, right? That stuff can be transformed into other. Well, the atoms themselves are permanent. Well, we're not talking about atoms right now, are we? You're not going to have an experience of an atom. So he goes on and he says, from experience itself, it could never derive such a principle, partly because material objects cannot be so traced in all their alterations and dissolutions that the matter can always be found undiminished, partly because the principle contains necessity, which is always the sign of an a priori principle. Now, Kant says you can actually have these a priori principles, but those are categories of the understanding, pure concepts of the understanding. Those are not something that you actually encounter in experience itself. So, you know, this would apply to material objects just as much as to the soul as well. And so that's an important thing to think about. He also talks about external and internal experience. And he's talking about things that are real outside of us, which correspond to our external perceptions. And he says that this can be, in fact, proved to be not a connection of things in themselves, but for the sake of experience. So long as we're not trying to say that we grasp things in themselves, but we stick within the realm of experience, we can say, yeah, we actually intuit things in space and time, both externally in terms of objects that are there for us, and internally, our own grasping of ourself as the ich, the ego, the person that continues on in being. So he says, by means of external experience, I'm conscious of actuality of bodies as external appearances in space. In the same manner as by means of internal experience, I'm conscious of the existence of my soul in time. But this soul is cognized only as an object of the internal sense by appearances, Erscheinungen, that constitute an internal state and of which the being in itself, which forms the basis of the appearances, is unknown. And so he's going to be here criticizing and rejecting what he calls Cartesian, or interesting turn of phrase, material idealism. Descartes quite famously said, external substances, we can know something about them, but not all that much, but myself as a mind, I can know myself, right? I can know all sorts of things about myself. Then there's God as a third kind of substance. We can't know that much about God, but enough to get the project going, right? So he says, Cartesian idealism does nothing but distinguish external experience from dreaming and the conformity to law of the former, that is external experience, from the irregularity and false illusion of the latter. In both, it presupposes space and time as condition of the existence of objects. Only inquires whether the objects of the external senses, which we, when awake, put in space, are actually to be found in it as the object of the internal sense, the soul is in time. That is, whether experience carries with it sure criteria to distinguish it from imagination. And Kant says, this can be disposed of. We already do that in common life by investigating the connection of appearances in both time and space, according to what he's discussed earlier in the work, universal laws of experience. So he says material idealism is very easily refuted, and you know, we don't have to go down Descartes' path. He says that the ego in the proposition I am means not only the object of internal intuition, but also the subject of consciousness, what it is that is conscious, what underlies consciousness. And this is kind of a analogous, he says, to the question of bodies as appearances of the external sense exist as bodies in nature apart from my thoughts. And he's going to say that the question whether I myself as an appearance of the internal sense, in parentheses, the soul according to empirical psychology, exist apart from my faculty of representation in time is an exactly similar question and must likewise be answered in the negative. So I am not two separate things, the faculty of representation in time and the appearance of the inner self, the soul of empirical psychology. I'm just what I am. And he says, the formal, which I've called transcendental, actually abolishes the material or Cartesian idealism, right? So we don't arrive at a knowledge of the soul as the subject, right? As some sort of enduring or permanent substance. But we do have this as an idea. And we want to be careful that we don't get misled into attributing more to the soul than we are warranted in affirming of it. It's an idea. It's not an object, a reality that we could know exhaustively. So this is the psychological idea or ideas, the first of the transcendental ideas that Kant is going to discuss in the third part of the Prolegomena. Special thanks to all of my Patreon supporters for making this podcast possible. You can find me on Twitter at Philosopher70, on YouTube at the Gregory B. Sadler channel, and on Facebook on the Gregory B. Sadler page. Once again, to support my work, go to patreon.com/sadler. Above all, keep studying these great philosophical works.